This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Napalm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard.
Happy holidays, everyone. Welcome to I Was There Too, the show where I, Matt Gourley, talk to people who were there in the great scenes of cinema and sometimes even television history, as you will find today. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa. May you have a festival of lights. The point is, all of those holidays are really just a thin excuse for us to get together with our beloved kin out of the shadow of the empire and celebrate the real and only true holiday of the season, and that's the Wookiee Life Day. And we're going to do just that today as we talk to a wonderful man, Larry Hyder, cameraman for the entire shoot of the infamous and wonderful Star Wars Holiday Special from 1978. It was on CBS one time. It's never since been officially released or really even recognized by Lucas himself or Lucasfilm. It's sort of the Tibet to Lucas's China. But I saw this thing when it aired, when I was a kid. I barely remember it, but there's no way I would have missed this thing. I lived and breathed Star Wars. I had a bootleg copy as soon as they were available. I even own the Wookiee storybook that I've had since I was a child. How much do I love Star Wars? I think it's clear. But if it wasn't clear enough, I'd like to take this moment to just outright brag about the fact that I am now part of the Star Wars official canon. And so is my lovely wife-to-be, Amanda Lund. Because God bless these guys. Ben Acker and Ben Blacker, writers extraordinaire, creators of the Thrilling Adventure Hour, have a new young adult Star Wars novel called Join the Resistance, wherein there is a planet called Dirk Teal, which every one of you already knows is the home of the reptilian Sarin species. And on that planet is a commerce center, now known, in the canon of Star Wars, soon to be posted on Wikipedia, as Gourley Lund. That's how you know I have the authority to speak today on the Star Wars Holiday Special. It's been a show that's been in my sights for a long time. And in fact, I even said in the first episode of this very podcast that one day I'd like to get somebody from this Star Wars Holiday Special to find out, quote, what was going on there. It begins with 15 minutes or so of just Wookiees growling with no subtitles and having just a domestic comedy? I don't know. I've talked about this before on a really special episode of How Did This Get Made with Paul Scheer, and I can't recommend that enough as the perfect companion piece for a 1-2 holiday Wookiee Star Wars punch for you and yours this holiday season. That's all there is to say, except for stay tuned after the interview for one more special visit from Starship One, the mysterious real person that did in fact audition for Star Wars Episode 8, and we'll see if I can get any more information out of her about her experience trying out for a role in the next installment of the Star Wars franchise. All right, season's greetings, everyone. Here we go.
The TV show, the Star Wars Holiday Special, the year 1978. The job, cameraman. The cameraman, Larry Hyder.
Larry Hyder, I'm going to treat this interview in the context of one man's journey through perhaps the strangest and most bizarre piece of television in all of recorded history. First, how familiar were you with Star Wars in the first place? And were you going blind into this whole thing, or did you have some kind of context?
To be honest, I wasn't a big Star Wars fan at that point. I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. I was busy traveling all over. I'm not even sure I saw the Star Wars movie until after I did this TV show.
And were you aware of the phenomenon at all, even though you hadn't seen it, or this was just kind of another job for you?
No, I was aware that it was a big deal. Uh-huh. You know, anything attached to George Lucas, you know, it's got to be something interesting, and Spielberg. And so those guys, if they do something, you know, it tickles you.
Yeah. So I'm trying to see this thing not only in the context of when it aired, but also when it was taped. What was the general feeling from the performers and technicians about this? Star Wars was sweeping the nation at this time, but there must have been some excitement. But were people aware that there was something slightly off about this production?
Oh, no. We were all very excited to get the call to do it. Smithsonian Productions put it together with Lucasfilms, and they were hired because they were the biggest variety show format in the business. And They definitely put on big shows. I mean, it was at the time of television where it wasn't concerts or one-offs. It was like one production song could take 18 hours, 20 hours to get it right. All the lighting, all the camera angles, get the right performance. It was very much a very high-end black tie kind of a production company. So going into it, we got a call, yeah, we're doing this thing at Warner Brothers, and it's going to be a big show, and you know, we want you to, of course, be there. So I was very looking forward to it.
Yeah. You had worked with them previously?
I did. I started working with them in 1976, and during that period was kind of the golden age of variety television. So We were very busy. I was traveling literally all around the world doing shows in various locations.
Wow, man. So,
yeah.
What a life at the time.
It was, yeah. It was a different time. Yeah.
So were you pretty much shooting all of the scenes throughout this thing, or did you have select moments or segments, or how did that work for you as a cameraman?
Well, the idea going into it, and Smithsonian, usually Dwight Hemian was the director of choice of that production company, but they were both hired as producers, and the people who were putting it together in Lucas terms brought in David Okumba, who is a Canadian documentary director.
Right. This is someone he had gone to USC film school with, I think,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right. And he was living in Montreal, and nobody knew him. And, of course, you come into a show with your best client not being the guy in charge makes you wonder, wow, what's this about? But okay, you know? So Dwight stayed away a little bit. He stayed, you know, didn't get involved. He just wanted to be there and offer what he could. And David you know, we had these big production numbers where, you know, the opening 10-minute sequence from the Wookiee house when...
Yeah, this opening segment was pure Wookiee dialogue with no English language whatsoever, not even any subtitles.
Yeah, and actually, for most of it, we didn't even hear the Wookiee-ish stuff because, you know, they were all in costume and they couldn't get a good sound quality with all the masks on and, you know, the Wookiee heads and everything else. So it was just kind of like, wow, it's almost like a silent film here.
Yeah.
But the overall, we thought we usually do things one camera at a time with that company. You know, you get the right camera in the right position for one part of it, and then you stop and then you move things around and get the lighting right for the next part. So it was very much the idea was to do multi-camera, like three-camera shoot, which helps you move faster through all the things you need to get.
Kind of like you would do a live taping or a studio audience taping.
Yeah, well, now it would be like 20 cameras and robos and everything else. But back then, multi-camera meant three or five at the most. So David was used to shooting with one camera. And so he didn't come from the school of, well, you know, we'll get two cameras, and when the, you know, when the Wookiee turns around, we shoot it from the other way. Well, that wasn't the way. The lighting director, John Rook, who was also just an incredible lighting man, he didn't see it that way. You know, and Smith Hemming didn't see it that way. So it got to be a conflict. You know, it's like David would want to take a lot of time and do this one move and then stop and turn around and do everything else. But he wasn't very – his explanation of what he wanted wasn't good. I mean, working with – I don't think he worked with actors all that much in what he did in his end. So we kind of – we were all set to go and, hey, let's go. We're going to really do something. And then we find ourselves sitting around for 10, 12 hours waiting for this one scene to be done. And that became an issue throughout I think we shot for like 10 days. That started to be a problem with just a budget.
You know? Did any of his footage, because he's eventually let go, right?
Yes.
Did any of his footage remain in the final
thing? Sure. Okay. Yeah. I don't remember all the different parts of the show. Whatever he did shoot, we were doing because the set was in the stage. They were very big sets. Whatever he did, they wouldn't stop and, you know, throw it out and bring in another director to do the same thing. Uh-huh. They just kind of carried on from when Steve came and Steve Bender. It didn't help the show at all to kind of have two different kind of feels to it. You know?
Right. I read something, too, about the set being basically the Wookiee house being a 360-degree set, but that was very difficult for lighting camera work.
Yeah,
and stuff.
That's always a problem, and that concept held things back, too.
It seems like every decision from the onset was sort of from the wrong direction.
Yeah, and, you know, and Dwight Hemian were not – they were like the – Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra, Shirley MacLaine people, and they didn't, I think, get – it was in terms of Star Wars. So they didn't have much to offer. And what are the alternatives? You know, they just kind of have, this guy wants to do it this way, so that's what we got to do, you know. And nothing against David. I've never seen him since that time, but I respected him, and I thought that he had an idea in his head of how he wanted to get it done. And unfortunately, it didn't work out that was a good way to do it.
I'm more than curious to think about what his finished version would have been, if it would have been much different, or would we be talking about it today? I mean, from the script originally, we probably still would be talking about it.
But. Yeah. I mean, the things we did towards the end were like the big ending with all the Wookiees are all on the mountaintop with all the...
The Life Day celebration.
Yes, the Life Day celebration.
That
might have taken
a few days ago,
a couple lives to shoot a single camera style. You know,
I had read too about that there was literally no money in the budget for that set. Like they almost forgot about it.
Yeah.
Whereas one day someone, I don't know if it was a production designer, said, "What are we doing for the set on this?" And someone else goes, "Oh, well, we don't have any money left." And it was like an afterthought. And
smoke,
smoke, black void,
and
robes. And then literally costumed all those Wookiees in like store-bought Don Post commercial Wookiee masks.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they're back to the camera, most of them, except for, you know, the main characters. So,
yeah.
I mean, that point, we all just wanted to get this done, you know. We had gone from oh boy to oh no.
Yeah. What was that like, your emotional arc over something like that? Was there a lot of chatter between takes between you and the other camera person?
A lot of eye rolling maybe. Yeah, but, you know, it's like when you're working with someone, you want to try to help. And part of our frustration is we couldn't help. You know, it's like things were too far off kilter for us to just jump in and say, you know, I think maybe if you do this or do that, there wasn't that space to do that. I had a camera on me. I had my Nikon that I traveled with. And so I just concentrated on taking pictures for my own sense of having to done something with the production.
Yeah, you know? We're going to take a look at those in a bit. Let's go through some of the specific segments in this 90 minutes, over 90 minutes, really, without commercials. That's without commercials. Yeah, it was a two-hour broadcast special. Event. And I say event in the same way that some natural disasters are. were you present? The one that always stuck out to me, and I'm not alone in this, is the Diane Carroll vision sequence that Chewie's father-in-law puts on. Is it his father-in-law or his natural father? Well, we'll get to the bottom of that later. I think that's not important. He puts on this visualizer machine, and she speaks to him in a very strange and erotic way. Mm-hmm. Were you present for the shooting?
Oh, sure.
And what was the thinking in that? Was it ever spoken about?
You know, I think most of us, at least I felt that, wow, now here's something that we know how to do. You know, we can shoot a song, right, you know, that's pretty basic, you know, and she was beautiful. She had an amazing wardrobe. I mean, she that's was sure. just really awesomely beautiful. And so it was eye candy for us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was like, oh, boy, now we know how to do this. Great.
You're looking on the bright side, because I think I would be going, what is the context of this? She's talking to a Wookiee. But now that I think, because I've done some other research and I had read originally that according to co-writer Leonard Ripps, Lucas told him that Han Solo was married to a Wookiee, but that they couldn't mention that because it would be controversial. So to see the scene with Diane Carroll kind of very sensually romancing an elderly Wookiee starts to make a lot of sense. And I'm wondering what Lucas's secret agenda might have been.
I think his agenda at that point might have been to get some name talent in the show and kind of turn it around to be a variety show a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, get out of the story a little.
So how about the Jefferson Starship performance? That was probably something that was kind of up your alley.
Yeah. Too, yeah. You know, I actually was pretty busy in that. So I didn't have a lot of picture taking during that part because I was working a lot and doing that part of it. It was fun to have music on the stage, you know, and it was, again, something that we kind of knew how to do, you know.
How long all told was this shoot?
I think it was 10 days and they were very long days.
Yeah.
It was like doing a movie, really, and it's not that we hated it. It's not at all, but you get tired after a while, and you want to move forward. And it was just ponderous, you know.
Right.
It's like walking in through mud. You know, I don't mean that in a bad way, in mud, but sticky. You know,
it's
like you just could not get forward very fast.
Yeah.
You know?
I had read also, there's this great oral history online called Dark Side: An Oral History of the Star Wars Holiday Special that. The cantina scene specifically was very hot, and the rest of the shoot and the Wookiees themselves could only go for about 45 minutes at a time before they needed oxygen. And
yeah.
There was some fainting happening. And
That's correct.
Of thing. Ooh,
that was the beginning of most of the real troubles. I mean, outside of the opening family thing, is that all these characters in the cantina, they were pretty much the same makeup and wardrobe and effects that came in the movie.
Uh-huh.
And some of them were actually, I believe, the actors who were there movie. So they, you know, when they make the movie, they do it all in pieces, you know, and they give everybody a chance to, you know, get their lines together or whatever. But the cantina, I mean, it was really hot because it was in a set with a lot of hot lights. The director of photography liked to light from the floor to give it a good look. So there's these big hot lamps standing there. 10 feet away from the characters, and they started to, one of them almost passed out.
Oh, boy.
And so just getting them hydrated and cooled down became a real long process for us to move forward with getting the scene shot.
And plus you've got Bea Arthur and Harvey Korman in that scene. How were they handling it?
They were fantastic.
Really?
Oh, Harvey was, he just laughed his way through the
really?
Whole thing.
Really? He's the best guy. I love him.
Yeah, he was really a champion. Bea was Bea. I have other stories from other shows about Bea, but she.
Because you worked on the Golden Girls as well, right?
I did a few episodes,
okay.
But I wasn't a regular player on it. But she was kind of known to be kind of difficult sometimes. You know, she has a very strong personality.
Yeah, I think you say in your oral history segment that she was very not unlike her character Maude in the
right,
show.
Right, right. It's very true. She was a controlling kind of person. So she was not thrilled. You know, but. Again, Harry, the whole process was made better by Harvey's, you know, it's like just really being fun.
I would have loved to have been there. I would have loved to have met that man. I think he's brilliant.
He actually poured, and I have pictures of it, he poured a glass of whatever they were drinking at the bar in the canteen and just poured it right over his head, you know, just for fun.
Really?
You know?
Yeah. And because he has that head mouth in the show itself that he sort of drinks from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And so how about Art Carney?
Art was great. You know, he's getting up in age at that point, and I don't think he really understood too much about what this all big deal was about.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But he was a consummate pro. Yeah. I mean, he was there. He knew his lines. He knew what to do with it, you know. And he had a great sense of humor, too. Really liked working with him.
Really?
Yeah.
So let's talk about the big three from the Star Wars film themselves, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, and Mark Hamill. What was your experience like working with them? How much did they want to be there, didn't want to be there?
Well, they how can I say this without hurting anybody? Harrison Ford had to be there. From my understanding, contractually, he didn't have an option because it was in his contract that had the kind of promotional stuff with Star Wars. So I think he was only there for a total of 2 days out of that whole time. And they had him once he was in his Millennium Falcon, and they were doing some interior shots of him, you know, in the cockpit. And he was just really just wanted to get it done.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted everything to be ready, lit, ready to go. And just he wanted to do it, boom, and then goodbye.
No disrespect to him, but I think that comes through in his performance.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. That might be his character's underlying motivation. But it works because he wants to get out of there because of the Empire, too.
You know? Right.
We'll chalk it up to that. We'll get to Carrie Fisher in a second. Mark Hamill, was he a little bit more game, it seems?
Yes,
maybe?
Yes, he was. Although he, too, was going, what are we doing? You know, it's like, and I have some photos to support that, too. It's like, he kind of had his hands in his pockets a lot, you know, going, what are we doing? And waiting, you know. But he was a trooper. He knew what to do, and he did what was expected of him. So
yeah. And now Carrie Fisher, God bless her, she looks like she might be how can I say this, like recreationally sedated in a way at times.
That I can't speak to. Yeah, that. No, I don't know.
I won't ask you to.
The way they come out of their trailer is the way they come out of their trailer. You know, all I can say is she did a good job on the set. Yeah. You know, she looked beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, she was still – and now it's come out, of course, that she and Harrison might have had been hooking up.
Yeah, it seems
during
confirmed,
that time frame.
Right.
So,
that's right. Yeah. I wonder if this was post-affair or during or, you know.
This might have been the first time since the film that
that's
they got
right.
back together.
I know. There could have been some real tension there on Life Day.
Yeah.
She did look beautiful. I love that sort of 70s television cinematography where it's – what would you call that? That soft light exposure that they
– Just – yeah. They – it's kind of a filtered – forgiving kind of approach,
yeah, which she wouldn't have even needed, but it makes her look all the more beautiful too.
But part of that too is that era of television technology was still in the early stages, and so nothing was really all that sharp compared to what the cameras do now with all their 4K capabilities. So it's a different look for sure of anything done in that time frame.
Do you have a preference for that kind of vintage look as opposed to today's high definition?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, it's the new technologies now, and this is probably boring stuff, but the cameras we work with now are very close to what they're using in the digital world of feature films.
Right.
And so what they do is just gather raw footage, and then it's got so much depth to it that you can make it look whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
In the television days of the 70s and even into the 90s, it was a different thing where you had to service the camera that could just do this pretty much one kind of look. And again, I see John Rook, the lighting director, he knew how to make people look really, really good.
I mean,
he was a very tasteful man. He was a Brit, too, and he kind of like had a very good sense of British humor. And, you know, his crew were always like very respectful, but also knew that, you know, he was kind of pulling their leg a little bit sometimes.
So you wrap the production. How long is it from wrap to when it airs? It's not like a film, so it probably wasn't even that long. Huh?
No, it was like 2 months, I think, or something like that. But it came up against, was it?
It was November 17th, and I'm not sure what it was on against that night, but I do know, unfortunately, the Jonestown Massacre was the next day, so it was, Yeah, rough couple of days.
Yeah, a lot of, I guess hard to focus on a Star Wars television special and all that's going on.
Did you watch it when it was broadcast?
No. I might not have even been in the country at that time. I don't know.
You had to get out.
Well, yeah, maybe.
So you told me that you tracked it down later on a bootleg VHS copy off eBay. Is that right?
Yeah, I did get it. I wanted to get a copy of it from Smithsonian, but they were they said, no, we can't really do any copies for you because it's not our content. You know, it's Lucas's. So.
And he is notoriously tight-gripped on that thing.
Yeah. So I just went on eBay, and I found one that was for sale in English from somebody in Germany.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I took a week, and there it was. And I got to say, it's like just getting through that first 10 minutes was so hard.
It's a tough 10 minutes to start with.
Yeah.
Did you get through that first 10 minutes?
I did. I managed to. One time, I think I managed to watch most of it in one sitting.
That's quite a feat. I want to read some critical reactions from the people in the production themselves. Carrie Fisher said that she shows it at parties, mainly at the end of the night when I want people to leave. David Hofstede, author of What Were They Thinking? The 100 Dumbest Events in Television History, ranked the holiday special at number one, calling it the worst 2 hours of television ever. That's a little harsh.
It is harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nathan Rabin of the AV Club wrote, I'm convinced the special wasn't ultimately written and directed by a sentient bag of cocaine.
No, I think if it had made like 5 years later, that might have been true.
Yeah.
It was more of a pot show, I think.
Probably. That makes sense. And then finally, George Lucas himself disliked the special and reportedly said, if I had the time and a sledgehammer, I would track down every copy of that show and smash it. So
I've read that too. And I think he means it.
Yeah, I think so too. But I have a real fondness for this thing. I think nobody's under any illusions that they were making another Star Wars. It was a variety television show. And that is a format that I adore and love and miss greatly too.
You're the one.
No, I'm not the only one. I have so many people that feel that way too. And I feel like the format is ripe for comeback. In fact, Maya Rudolph was experimenting with that format for specials for TV. And
oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. A couple of years ago, I was invited to that, but I wasn't available. But
I would love to see that.
I
have
my fingers crossed. I mean, I would love to get back into that format, you know, before my time here is done. But
it would be great if they not only revived the format, but brought all the same crew technicians back. I swear I was raised on the Barbara Mandrell show. I love that show so much. So let me take a look at some of the photos that you have from your time on there, if you don't mind.
And of course.
I'll narrate what I'm seeing here a little bit.
I have like 200 some pictures. I did a folders. I cut it down to like the best of the ones that are available. One is called cast and one is called guest.
Okay.
And the I think I put prime.
Star Wars Holiday Special cast. Is it that one?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I will talk through some of these. A lot of them are from his private collection, so we won't necessarily see them on the web page for this episode, but some you might.
I call it my vault.
Your vault, yes. This is a real treat for me. I feel like I'm a member of an elite club. These are coveted pictures.
Well, the club of people who like Star Wars, so yeah.
We are legion. All right, Art Carney looking like he's working with an industrial sewing machine.
Mm-hmm. I think that was part of that whole thing with Diane Carroll.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a guy in a stormtrooper suit.
Right.
Oh, man, I would have died to have been that guy when I was a kid. Who are these people just hanging out on the Wookiee
set? That's Gary Smith and Dwight Hamian, and I have a kind of a series of those. And they're just – it seems like that's the perfect way to look at what they had to do with the show.
Yeah.
You're like they're in a big empty space, and they're off by themselves, and they're kind of like going, what do we do now?
They're sitting on the steps of the Wookiee living room. By the way, say what you will about this show, I would live in that Wookiee house in a heartbeat. It's an incredible set.
The smell, I don't think he'd pass the smell, though.
Really?
Well, you know Wookiees.
So. Oh, that's right. All right, here's some just Imperial Guards on break. That is a great picture when you get to see the Imperial Guards just resting in their natural state. Oh, this is a great picture, too, of just two stormtroopers knocking at the door.
That's like, when they're coming to take one of the Wookiees away.
That's right. But it almost feels like they're missionaries who have come to pass out some leaf behinds and talk to you about the good news of the Empire. That's an incredible photo. I love that.
Quite Jehovian. But.
Now, who? There's a picture.
That's
of,
the guy who played the main Wookiee.
Amala?
Yeah. That's the actor from the film as well.
And this is Chewbacca then?
Yeah. And that's him with his head off because of the, just taking a break, getting some air.
Looks different.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
He's got the black cheeks just because there were some holes, the breathing holes, and so that made the effect look better.
Now, here's Art Carney posing with Mala the Wookiee.
Right.
That is a picture probably many people think would have never happened in time and space.
Yeah, he had a good sense of humor about it. He really did.
Oh, here's a great picture of Itchy, the elderly Wookiee, sitting down in his erotic vision chair.
Yeah.
Okay.
Creepy.
Yeah. even the fellas looking on there.
Yeah, that's the guy. They had like the guy in the center with the glasses. He's a special effects guy, and they had some way to manipulate some of his bodies, I guess, to move around or things.
Okay. That's even creepier to hear, I think. All right. Oh, here are all the Wookiees out of their masks. That is an interesting picture.
Yeah, it's like a family photo.
Yeah. Who's that there?
That, I'm pretty sure that is a very famous agent.
Oh.
A Hollywood agent.
He sure looks like
it. Yeah.
Wow, his shirt is open.
I can't remember
his
name offhand.
Ankles.
It's been a while since I looked at these, but he was there that day. That one day, and so he made his presence felt.
This is like one of the dancers up close in that like hologram sequence or something, right?
Isn't that the guy from Kiss? I think.
Like Gene Simmons?
I wouldn't say that for sure, but it was one of the Kiss guys.
It might as well be. Wow, these are incredible. Here's Harvey Korman getting set up to do some cooking.
Right, and that's David Okumba with him.
That's a great picture of Harvey Korman as the Julia Child space cook without his wig. There's the Life Day celebration set. They managed to get some kind of little mountain.
Right, that was some paper mache.
Last minute mountain coming up. R2-D2. Are there any pictures of you in this?
There's one with me and R2 in there.
Is it this one?
No, that's Sam. That was Steve Bender, the director.
Oh, okay. There's Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher with C-3PO. So were you in one of these cameras that's like where you're seated or you're standing?
No, that's a crane camera. That's Wayne Orr. He was another colleague of mine who worked with Smith-Hemion all the time. And he was really one of the best guys at doing that particular kind of camera.
Yeah.
He was really very, very good.
That's got to be you, right?
That's me. That's doing a selfie in 1978.
That's a great picture.
Right?
Oh, that's great.
I had a lot of time.
Now, here's a picture of what I know to be the Snaggletooth character from Star Wars operating
good.
A camera.
That's Wayne again. He actually, it was his idea. He said, hey, Larry, let me do this. So he grabbed one of the heads from the wardrobe people and he put it on his head and I took the picture. He loves it. I'm sure he had it blown up to like a poster size.
I would too. Are you kidding? It would go above my bed. All right, there's B. Arthur. That's great. Oh, there you are with RTTV.
That's me.
Now, do you have a picture of that printed out anywhere and up on the wall?
No, it's a story about I had a dark room at that time frame in a little studio, and I did a lot of black and white enlargement, and
these
that's why
photos.
I shot these in black and white.
Yeah.
And I had some time off after this show, and I went into the darkroom and I spent like 3 days and I printed out about 40 of the best pictures and I put them together in a little album that I wanted to give to Gary Smith and Dwight Hemion as, kind of like a memento of the show. And I just put them in a plain old, Staples kind of folder.
Yeah.
And I took it to another show that we were working on and we were doing a wrap party from there. And I said, hey, Dwight, I got something to show you. And I gave it to him, and he looked through it, and he said, oh, this is amazing. I said, are these for us? And I said, yeah, you just, enjoy it. And they disappeared. I don't know what happened to them. I guess he put them down. I don't know if somebody just picked it up and threw it away.
Oh, no.
Or if somebody somewhere has these pictures and just have kept them under wraps, which I find hard to believe. But
do you still have the negatives?
Or maybe one of George Lucas's people has it and just waiting for me.
He's got spies.
So that's the only time they were ever printed. I had these digitally scanned by a company that does negative to digital scanning now. But
that's good.
No prints are anywhere else as far as I know.
Now, this looks like a Steadicam. Was this an early version of a Steadicam?
That was like Series 1 television Steadicam, yeah.
Did they shoot Steadicam on this production? I don't remember.
They used it. Really? I mean, but it wasn't used like it is today where you're running around circles
and
all
that stuff.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be like The Shining or anything.
It was just a method to get some interesting angles.
Oh, interesting. Wow, these color ones are beautiful. The saturation of the color.
Yeah, there was a Kodachrome slides. I wish I had now, of course, used color instead of black and white because it definitely would make it more of the realm. But
these are great pictures. It's easy to see why you're a cameraman. I mean, if you capture what in motion what you do in a still, that's really impressive.
Thank you.
All right, for to wrap this up, I want to go through some of your other credits. I sometimes like to do a thing where I will just name something that you've worked on, mm-hmm. and you can either say pass or tell us a little bit about it if okay. something comes to mind. Okay,
sure.
All right, American Idol.
Pass.
Okay. Dancing with the Stars.
Okay. I did Dancing with the Stars for about 3.5 years. That translates into 7 seasons, I guess. So we did it twice a year.
My stepmom would stop you and talk to you for hours about
this
if she were
here. Yeah, that was our target audience.
It was my stepmom.
Women who like dancing, pretty much. It was pretty much all female audience at the time. And that was a great experience. The director was a Brit who used a method of every shot had a number and every beat had a beat to it. So we were constantly being talked through the song with somebody in the background, 1, 2, 3, 2, 2, 3, 4.
Like the rhythm of the song?
Yeah, and then we had all our shots would be numbered, and sometimes they came pretty fast. It was very technically challenged. It wasn't for me, it wasn't a creative effort, more of a just can I get through all this in the right order live without making a mistake.
And, like and the dancers all the camera themselves, guys felt the same
way. And the answer, they had more of a rehearsal time, I think, to get it right. And they were all, of course, real pros. I mean, they were really good. But it was a good time on the show. I enjoyed doing it. After a while, I wanted to go out and explore other opportunities. So I left that show to go on to other things.
Oh. Stevie Wonder Songs in the Key of Life, an All-Star Grammy Salute.
Yeah, anything but Stevie is gold.
It's got to be.
I've shot him dozens of times over the years. He's always one who likes to put his art out there. But the thing about Stevie is that there was like regular time and overtime, and then there was Stevie time. And he's notorious for being late. And then when he gets there and he gets the gear all set up, he sits down, and if it's not right, he leaves, and they come in and they fix it, and then he comes back. So it's a real process. But the end result, of course, is just gold.
Just a little something called the Academy Awards.
Yeah, yeah. I've done award shows probably more than any other format in my life.
And because you've got the Grammys, the Golden Globes, and you're an Emmy winner yourself, right?
Yeah. I've been lucky a couple times.
Wow.
And, award shows, they're not creative per se, but they're challenging and they're live, and you don't want to make any mistakes. The old golden years of television usually didn't involve this kind of shot making with 15, 16 cameras and different angles and everything very critical, fine-tuned, So it's a challenge doing that. It's like being like a jet pilot in a world where you'd rather be the barn sweeper kind of guy who does the loops in the sky.
Oh, yeah, like a barnstormer?
Yeah,
that's right.
It's two different things,
Monty Python's Flying Circus live at Aspen.
That was great. That was a great little show. They do an annual comic show in Aspen, and we went up there for HBO to do a show, and it was a reunion of all the Pythons, except for
Graham.
Graham was there. They had him the urn there, and
when they did this. Yeah,
yeah, and they were kind of like in a talk show kind of scene. Everybody sitting around just talking, telling stories about all that, and Graham, of course, and then of course there was a moment which we didn't rehearse where one of them, I forget who picks up the urn to pass it, and it opens, it falls to the ground, and the ashes are all over the carpet.
Yeah.
And we're going, oh no, what are we going to do? And then when somebody else grabs a vacuum cleaner and vacuums it up, you know, it was hilarious. And we didn't know it was going to happen. That was definitely just something that they had for us, you know, to do. And the audience just ate it up. It was just hilarious.
That's,
you know,
incredible. Sinatra, 80 Years My Way.
Yeah, yeah. So Frank is one of my icons. I've got most of his music. I've read books about him. I've got all the lanyards and the passes from the times I worked on his shows. I just love his music. By 80, Frank, you know, was definitely not in his form. But I love the songs that he made famous, and so it was just a pleasure for me to work on that kind of a thing.
Yeah,
I did when they did one of his last tours. He went out with Stephen Eady and Dean Martin, and they went on a tour. And it was unfortunate that by that time he was already using teleprompters on the bottom, you know, set in the corners of the stage. He would do it in the round, like his main event kind of thing. But he had to read the lyrics to stay up with it at all, and yeah. It was kind of difficult to have to shoot it that way, but you know, because I saw him at his prime. And,
right. Well, if I had that many songs, I would probably need some reminding.
Oh, that's true too. Yeah.
Speaking of Sammy and Frank and Dean, Sammy Davis Jr.'s 60th anniversary celebration.
Yeah, that was an amazing show. Sammy was already in one of his last stages of lung cancer.
Oh, wow.
But he was there in the audience, and Gregory Hines did a tap dance number that dancing in Sammy's way that was pretty unique, and it was just a showstopper. It was so great, and it was so good that Gregory invited Sammy to come up from the audience, and he was in the first row, and he wasn't supposed to, but he got up, and he went up there, and he danced with him, you know, and it was just one of those moments, you know, that you're just glad you could have seen that.
Yeah, you're at the front row of so many amazing things in television history.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I've had a really, really lucky life in that sense. You know, I've seen a lot of things that I never would have imagined.
Yeah, including my next one, the previously mentioned, The Golden Girls.
The Golden Girls, a sitcom, like most sitcoms, you know, three or four cameras, and, you know, they have different sets with the bedroom, the living room, all that stuff. But that set was great to work on. They all knew their lines all the time. They cracked each other up during rehearsal. They nailed it during the performance. It was no long days. You know, you're in, the show, you're out. Yeah, real pros, yeah.
A show that I used to watch as a kid, Solid Gold.
Solid Gold. Solid Gold Dancers, too. Yeah. That was at a time of shooting rock and roll that was fun.
Really? It was your face lit up.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. There's some good memories there. You know, it was just that show, like most of those shows, they were long days, you know, because you had different bands. They'd have to come in and sound check and rehearse and all that. And it's great now, I think, that it's going to be legal in California to have marijuana licenses, because back then we were definitely violating that principle. You know?
I think that was clear even to me, a six-year-old watching that show at the time.
Yeah. I don't know if it's in there, but Don Kirshner's Rock Concert was one of my shows too. And that was started like 1973 through 1980, I guess. And that was great rock and roll. I mean, I shot everybody, you know, and they really? All came through. And they all – it was like they'd come in and they'd do a full setup with their band. They'd do four or five songs, you know, with the audience right behind you getting into it. It's great.
Any favorite act on that one that you remember?
Musically, it's hard to remember them all, but they were all the people who were making music at that time in rock and roll. Mm-hmm. But it was also I was there for the first Steve Martin appearance in his white suit with the arrow in his head.
No kidding.
You know, that gag. And he did it for the audience. And it was pretty late at night by that point. We were in between acts. And nobody got it.
Really?
You know, they're going, what is this? Who is this guy? It's like, get him off the stage. Let's turn on the music. It was really, it didn't work, you know, but I thought it was great. I'd never seen anybody do any.
Well,
kind
you were
of
high as a
like
kite
that.
At the time.
Not necessarily, but it was very unique, you know. I wasn't stoned all the time.
No, I know. I'm just kidding.
Just when it was convenient.
By the way, this is Jeremy Van Cleve, who's
yes.
the an old work colleague of mine, friend. Yeah.
Yeah. Not old at all. Not very young.
He's 12. He is who I have to thank for bringing Larry in today. So thank you very much, Jeremy.
My pleasure.
Larry Heider, thank you so much for talking to me about this stuff. I really enjoyed your stories.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Matt. It's really a pleasure to meet you, too. And I think you've got a great, great project going here. I want
thank
to put,
you.
Find a space on this table where I can put my name. I don't know where.
I'm going
to
hand you a Sharpie right now
okay.
to do just that.
Excellent.
And Jeremy, thank you very much for making this happen.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm proud to know him, and it's usually this time of year that we get together for holidays. And this time last year, he goes, I got to show you these photos from this Star Wars TV show. And I was like, what?
Did you ever know this about him?
I went to – he invited me to tapings for things, but I didn't know he shot that show. And when he mentioned that he had those photos and I started looking through them, it blew my mind. And then, of course, I'm a huge fan of your show. And when you started doing the Star Wars trilogy episodes
yeah. –
I mean, this just seemed like an obvious idea.
It certainly – I'm certainly glad that you thought of it. Jeremy was an old work colleague of mine at Disney. We should probably do an episode someday if I was there too working at a theme park. But you still work there, right?
I still work there, yeah. It would be a tricky line.
I know. I'll just have you feed me information and I'll pass it off as if it's mine.
That's true. That's
okay.
true.
Well, it's good to see you again. And thanks again, Larry.
Oh, my pleasure. As Zach Carney would have said, may the farce be with you.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you, Jeremy. What a wonderful couple of guys. And what a wonderful tour through the wooden tree huts of Kashyyyk. And now, as promised, and since this is another Star Wars episode, probably the last for a while, let's check in again with a very secret, mysterious, and important guest, someone that goes by the pseudonym Starship One. She won't reveal her real name because... and this is true, she did in fact audition for Star Wars Episode 8, and because that was such a top-secret, for-your-eyes-only audition, cannot reveal her true identity, and the first interview I had with her a while back was to discuss some of the particulars of the plot and the story, which ultimately she provided none of, and then I did a follow-up interview with her to try to get more out of her, and again, got nothing. And I think I'll try, for now at least, one last time to... wrestle some information from her about her role that she auditioned for, or the scene, or Star Wars in general. Maybe we'll check in with Rogue One. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you once again Starship One. Well, I'm back here a third time talking to a very mysterious and special person, Starship One, who auditioned for Star Wars Episode 8, as yet unsubtitled. And I've been trying to get some information about the scene that she auditioned for, the character she was going to play. Starship One, before I ask you again what those things are, how are you today?
I'm doing really well, Matt. Thank you.
Things are good. Are you enjoying your holiday season?
Yeah, the holidays are pretty good. I wish there was more snow.
So you don't live in a snowy climate. Now, that's something people can use to deduce, at least geographically, maybe where you live.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I do, maybe I don't. I think... that's, you know, you do what you will with that information.
What can you tell us about Star Wars Episode 8, having had some distance and time? Maybe it feels safer now to come out with some information.
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, Matt, I had to sign an NDA, so I can't really talk about too much stuff. What I can tell you is that the audition was held in Marina Del Rey, that the sides were on red paper so they couldn't be photocopied.
I think you told us both those things previously.
Okay. I was talking to a guy and he was saying, you know, oh, doesn't it look great here? We were in a planet.
Yeah, again, in a planet?
On a planet.
Well, were you just like on the earth, like dirt surface, or were you on like a paved surface or a metallic space surface?
you know, it didn't say in the description, but it was basically, it was just a really nice place.
Yeah, still not really any new information.
Yeah, but I can tell you that I auditioned, you know, for another movie and, you know, give you some info on that.
Oh, what's that?
Well, there's a movie out right now. It's a music-y type movie, and I auditioned for that.
Are you talking about La La Land?
Yes.
You auditioned for La La Land?
Mm-hmm.
For the Emma Rose Button, what's her name? Emma Stone?
Yeah, Emma Stone, uh-huh.
For that role?
Yeah.
Were you happy with how that movie turned out?
I'll tell you this, Matt, I had some problems with it.
Really? What was wrong with it?
It just wasn't what... Basically, I would have brought something else to the table.
What would you have brought?
Well, instead of, you know, some overcooked beets, I would have maybe put down a nice ambrosia salad.
Oh, so I haven't seen the movie, so she...
I just know me that I could have really taken it to a new place.
But most people are saying that this is one of the best films of the year, and you don't feel that.
Yeah, well, it's been a difficult year for movies.
In what way? Back that up.
Well, I mean, there haven't been a lot of good movies that have come out.
You're not big on information, are you?
I saw Sully. I didn't like that.
Yeah. Did you see Arrival?
I saw Arrival.
Did you like that?
It wasn't great.
What movies did you like?
Oh, you know what movie I saw that I loved?
What?
Captain Fantastic.
Oh, with Viggo Mortensen?
Yeah, I saw that the other day, and man, what a fun little movie that is.
So I think I'm now going to sort of use these interviews to drop clues as to your identity. So someone that lives in a non-snowy climate that likely has a copy of Captain Fantastic, or will in the future, we know that much.
Yep.
Again, I don't know who you are.
No, I know.
You're behind a baffle.
I know.
You were escorted in by armed men.
But seriously, you should check out Captain Fantastic, because it is fantastic.
Well, do you have any plans to audition for anything in the future?
Yeah, I've got a couple auditions coming up. It's pilot season. So I'm going to definitely be hitting the streets with, you know, my best shoes on, trying to win those roles from the other girls.
Hitting the streets with your best shoes on?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that industry speak?
I think so. In the circles I'm used to being part of.
Okay, well, this has been a great interview.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I was also asked to be in an Ariana Grande music video yesterday.
So it was Amanda. Can you talk about what you have to do in that?
The breakdown said that you have to wear pasties and wear underwear, and it would be a implied nudity.
But so not like Vegas stripper pasties with tassels, like nudie pasties.
Right, where you could just be like pushed up against a wall.
Right.
Well, I also got a Facebook message, direct Facebook message. And I said, you know what, buddy, take off the nudity and I'm your girl. But
so what came of that? Any response?
Well, my manager said it was a pass.
Oh.
And, you know, I said, okay. And, you know, hopefully next time they'll want women fully clothed.
Right.
Because I'd love to dance around in a fun dress or something.
Like in La La Land?
Well, I didn't audition for La La Land.
You didn't?
No.
Why'd you say you did?
Well, just because I have some thoughts on it. But I did audition for that Reese Witherspoon movie. That's real.
But you could have told me your thoughts on La La Land without lying about auditioning for it. Did you really audition for episode 8?
Yes. I auditioned for episode 8, the new Reese Witherspoon movie, but I did not audition for La La Land, though I would have liked to, and I do believe I would have brought something cool to the table.
Well, it's certainly been wonderful to talk to you one more time.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And anything you want to leave us with, Star Wars related?
May Christmas be with you.
Oh, God. Well, thank you very much, Julie.
No, Matt!
Well, that's it for this episode of I Was There Too, and that's it for this year of I Was There Too. Thank you to Starship One, Larry Hyder, Jeremy Van Cleve, and all my guests this year, and most importantly, to you, the listeners, for making this a wonderful year of movie talk and episodes. I hope you guys have a wonderful holiday. And as ever, if you can connect me to a great guest for this show, email me. I won't get in any other way. Email me at iwasthere2pod@gmail.com. Otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter at Matt Gourley and Instagram at Matt Gourley and Letterboxd at Matt Gourley or on Twitter at iwasthere2. Thanks, everybody. Merry Christmas. And pod bless us, everyone.
Hello, I'm Chris Gethard, and here with me is dream analysis expert
Gary Richardson.
And we are here to give you a taste of a brand new podcast called In Your Dreams, presented exclusively by the fine folks at Casper.
We listen to the wildest, weirdest dreams submitted to us by you, our listeners, and we do our best to figure out just what those dreams could possibly mean.
I look over the side of my bunk bed, and there are Huey Lewis in the news.
You're saying this person might have interests in style and fashion specifically. You can tell that from that voicemail.
99% certainty.
Plus, we'll be joined by some very special guests.
The word mortality comes to mind.
Mortality?
Blood.
Bloodtality.
Subscribe to In Your Dreams right now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Good night.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.